foot 9 inches or shorter. If that portion of Senate Bill 480 is enacted, Oregon should be eligible for that federal grant.
Okay, Senator Devlin, and you have a guest that you'd like to bring with you. So, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify here this afternoon in support of Senate Bill 480. As you might be aware, I was the chief sponsor of the initial booster seat law.
Senator Devlin, you have to give your name.
Yes. Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Colleagues, I believe Senate Bill 480 is a great improvement. It simplifies the current child occupant laws, making it easier for parents to understand where their child should be located in a vehicle. During my testimony, I will be discussing SB 480 with amendments. I believe the committee administrator has distributed the amendments to all members of the committee. Senate Bill 480, as amended, requires a person under 1 year of age, regardless of weight or under 20 pounds, to use a rear-facing child safety system. Requires those who are under 8 years of age and are under 4 foot nine to use an appropriate child safety system in motor vehicles, i.e. a booster seat. The Dash 2 amendments take out the clause that would require all children under the age of 13 to only ride in the back seat of a vehicle. Let me repeat that. The Dash 2 amendments take out the clause that would require all children under the age of 13 to only ride in the back seat of a vehicle. The Dash 4 amendments would remove the provision in the bill that made it illegal for drivers to transport more people in a vehicle than the vehicle's restraint systems can accommodate. Each section of 480 is based on comprehensive evidence that demonstrates the importance of child occupancy laws. For instance, rear-facing child restraints, infants. In frontal crashes, which are the most frequent and most severe, the primary restraint surface is the back of the child restraint seat, which is facing to the rear. They are the most effective. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that children should remain rear-facing until reaching the maximum weight for the seat. To prevent severe spinal injury, children should remain rear-facing until they are at least 1 year old. Booster seats are necessary for children under the height of 4 foot 9 and 80 pounds, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Why? Because they do not simply fit properly into a normal restraint system in a vehicle that's actually designed for an average male of about 5 foot 10, 160, 180 pounds. Also, you need the booster seat so that the lap belt will fit appropriately and so that the shoulder belt will fit appropriately. In implementing these sections, it should also be noted that Oregon would become eligible and would actually receive $400,000 in additional funding for basically safety programs to basically help ensure that children are safer in vehicles in this state. Our amendments actually come from discussions with the chief co-sponsor in the House side, Representative McPherson, who is sponsoring a similar bill. We're both doing this on behalf of Safe Kids. I think both of the amendments that I've identified are very clearly defined. If you would want, I could go into them in more detail, but let me just say it just very specifically here. We had a bill that had three specific provisions in it that we wanted to actually put into the bill, a fourth provision that actually got put into the bill. We are only doing the first two. This is only affecting very small children, infants under 1 year of age, to be in rear-facing restraint systems, and for booster seats to have an improvement, a vast improvement, in what our current definition is for those required. Our current definition is, our current definition is 6 or 80 pounds.
6 or 60.
And I cannot tell you how many times I have to define to people what or means. So the current definition is very confusing. This would simply mean that if you were 8, you would be automatically out of the seat. Very, very clear. If you happen to be an 8-year-old who is particularly big, and you're over 4'9", you would be out of the seat. No longer would we have all this confusion that we have with the current law, and actually our current law does not comply with the federal requirements that if we do comply with them, we will be able to obtain $400,000 in an additional safety-related funds. I urge your passage of this bill. I think the amended version can easily pass the Senate and far more easily pass the House.
Thank you, Senator Devlin. I commend you for the amendments, particularly the one on the 13-year-olds. I've seen some way, way tall 13-year-olds. I wanted to clarify, though, on the age 8, it also has a 4'9" standard, correct?
Yes.
In other words, it's not just 8 years old, because there are 8-year-olds who are way bigger than other 8-year-olds.
Yes. It basically what it is, that's why this gets so complex, Madam Chair, is that if you're 8, you're basically no longer required. If you're above 4'9", you're no longer required.
Okay,
if you happen to be a 7-year-old who is, I actually know an 8-year-old who is about 5'11", mm-hmm. you're not required.
Okay. All right. Well, then we'll stop it there before we get too much more complex. Are you done, Senator Pruszynski? Do you have any questions? Okay.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Senator Burdick, member of the committee. I'm Dr. Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society and Safe Kids Coalition of Oregon. And I'm here to testify in favor of this bill. We would like to see a stronger bill, but I think the amendments that are being proposed are good, and we support those. I'm here to answer any questions you might have about kids, booster seats, the value of prevention. Prevention is a major point that we like to emphasize to our parents to make sure that their children are properly restrained. This bill will strengthen that. Motor vehicle accidents are still the leading cause of death of children in the state of Oregon, and anything we can do to reduce the impact of that is a worthwhile goal.
Thank you. I want to thank you for your written testimony and for your work on this area. I happen to be someone who, when my daughter was 6 and was riding in the front seat in her booster seat, I happen to be a person who actually bought a new car so that I could get an airbag on the passenger side. And of course, then it wasn't too many years after that they started saying that, you know, the airbag and a kid in the front are the worst possible scenario. So I feel like karma requires me to, if nothing else, to look at this very seriously. Are there questions from the committee for Dr. Lace?
We would urge your passage.
I appreciate that. Why don't you just say what, you know, for those of us who, or those who, I use a booster seat, so I think my daughter was probably 9. She was on the small side for a while. What happens when you put a child who's too small just in a straight seat belt and there's a crash?
Several things happen. One, the whole goal of seat belts is to make sure that the seat belt comes across a structure in your body that's relatively hard. So an adult comes across your collarbone, or it should, and your hip belt ought to come across your hip, your shoulder, your clavicle up here, and then your hip area down there with the bone. If you put a child in where the seat belt comes up in here, you'll break the neck. You can actually take the whole head off, in a violent accident. Down here, if the seat belt comes up too high on the child, you'll crush injuries, liver, spleen, everything can just rupture because we're talking about a major, a force here. So it's really important to have those kids properly restrained and to make sure that the seat belt comes across the child in a proper way. And that's the whole goal of booster seats, the whole goal of having the children, the small babies and infants in proper car seats. I've been around long enough where we didn't have anything for people, and even when I was in medical school, we didn't even have seat belts. And just remembering all the ENT lectures about people flying out, you just saw the governor of New Jersey who wasn't wearing his seat belt and had some horrible injuries occur because he wasn't properly restrained. Don't ask me why not, but and he's riding with a trooper, of all things. But you know, those things happen, and people don't have a concept of what really goes on at 30 miles an hour, 40, 50, 60, and people get ejected, and people get, you know, horrendous injuries. And so the goal is to reduce those injuries, reduce the morbidity, reduce the mortality associated with motor vehicle accidents. They still are the number one cause of death, you know, of children in this state.
Again, thank you for coming. Appreciate it. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Senator Devlin, you can go on to your other committee. Okay, we have some trauma nurses talk tough here. Where's my seat here? You know who you are. Joanne Fairchild, Ruth Harshfield, and Tammy Franks. Welcome. Good to see you again, Joanne.
Thank you. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Joanne Fairchild. I am a trauma nurse coordinator responsible for injury prevention at Legacy Emanuel Hospital. I chair the Oregon Safe Kids Legislative Committee, and I am a former flight nurse, ER nurse, and ICU nurse. I am here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 480, requiring that children from 4 to 8 or 4 foot 9 are required to be properly restrained in a motor vehicle in booster seats, and babies up until at least 1 year of age are rear-facing. I've attached several research articles to my testimony that speak to this issue, but I'm a visual learner, so I also included pictures, and I didn't include anything terribly graphic. But the first picture that you'll see across my testimony is a typical, what we call, lap belt injury. This is a 7-year-old boy who was in a motor vehicle crash and ended up with abdominal injuries and spine injuries. The next page shows you why we're seeing that happen. My niece explained this to my father when she was very little, not having to do with booster seats, but the fact that he walked much faster than she did. And she said, "Grandpa, you have long legs, I have little legs." And that is the problem with our kids. In order to keep your lap belt way down low on the abdomen, on the hips, where the body bends, so it does, the back doesn't get broken, where you don't have guts that can pop, as I explain in safety belt classes, and when your bones are nice and strong, you have to have your bottom all the way back in the seat of the car to keep it down there. Plus, we big people have nice angles on our pelvic bones that children don't have. So children, to have their bottom all the way back, their legs stick straight out in front of them, which isn't comfortable. So they slump down under the lat belt, which means that it's going to end up right over their abdomen in a crash. When we put them in a booster seat, basically we've shortened the seat so they can sit with their bottom all the way back, bend their legs, and the belt fits them correctly. It also redirects it over their shoulder instead of up on their neck, because on the next page is a drawing first of a dummy properly restrained in a booster seat, and you'll see there's very little forward head movement. The other thing we see kids do is sit on the edge of the seat, put the shoulder harness behind their back, and then in a crash they come forward up over that lap belt. Their forehead hits the back of the seat in front of them and can literally disconnect their brain from their spinal cord, which is, as you can imagine, a fatal injury. So the next picture is a happy one. It's a pickup truck that rolled twice on the way to that stream. The driver didn't intend to be there, but hit some black ice on the roadway. There were two young boys, ages 5 and 6, in the back seat of the pickup. Both of them were properly restrained in their booster seats, and both of these children were totally uninjured in the crash. And that's what we're after. seats that fit our children since they are not adult size. The other thing booster seats do is move the adult system in closer to their body, so they're less likely in a severe crash to be totally ejected from the car. And with adult systems, they just don't hold them tight enough that in a rollover or a high-speed impact, they're going to stay in the seat at all. I also included some information about infants and why they need to be rear-facing in the seat of our car. Babies have great big heads and little rubbery bodies, and the most violent crashes are head-ons. If you have them rear-facing to that most violent crash, that whole car seat cradles their body and protects them in a crash. We'd all be safer if we rode rear-facing in a car, but at the very least, we need to do that for our babies. So that's why we're asking for these things. It's for the safety of our children. I teach safety belt classes, and I have parents say to me, because police come in and tell them what the law says, and then I say, no, forget all that. This is what you need to know to keep your child safe. And they're always, well, if that's what we need to do, then why doesn't the law tell us that? So we help parents know what is safest for their children. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Welcome. Whoever wants to speak next.
Honorable Jenny Burke, thank you for having me come today. I'm Ruth Harshfield. I'm the Executive Director for the Alliance for Community Traffic Safety. ACTS Oregon is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to reduce fatalities and injuries on Oregon's roadways. One of our primary programs is the Child Safety Seat Resource Center. And the Resource Center promotes the use and correct installation of car seats and booster seats throughout the state of Oregon. I'm here today to ask for your support for Senate Bill 480. ACTS Oregon supports all the provisions of Senate Bill 480, specifically the importance of using booster seats for children up to age 8 or 4'9", and the need to provide seats at a lower cost to our families that are in need of assistance in getting child safety seats and boosters for their children. Joanne has already mentioned some studies that have been done, and in my testimony I talk quite a bit about the Partners for Child Safety studies, which have been going on since 1999. These studies are conducted in cooperation with State Farm Insurance and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and they've provided us with really a lot of research that has shown the benefit of having children restrained up to age 8 and or 4'9". And so I refer to that. Joanne's already spoken some about the way belt positioning boosters fit. And at the Resource Center, we get a lot of calls from families wanting information on how to do things correctly. And so we will often get the question, when can my child get out of the car seat? You know, when do I have to not haul this around anymore? And so we basically, you know, let them know that they need to have their child sit in their vehicle and look. And if they're sitting all the way back, can they bend their knees? And if they can't bend their knees, they will. And at that point, they're slouching, the lap belts up on the stomach, and the shoulder belts across the neck. So we need them to stay in a booster until they can ride correctly. There's also, you know, the effectiveness of using booster seats, that they are 59% effective in reducing injuries compared to seat belts, which are 38% effective. And so we encourage those changes. The Resource Center operates a helpline. We receive over 5,000, almost 6,000 calls a year from people throughout the state, parents, grandparents, and professionals wanting to know about how to transport children safely. The top four areas of inquiry that we get are assistance in getting their child safety seats and booster seats checked so that they're sure they're using them correctly, clarification of Oregon's child passenger safety law. That's our second highest call that we get. The third would be access to low-cost child safety seats and booster seats for families who are lower income. When we answer these inquiries, especially questions about children over the age of 4 and 40 pounds, we explain the current law of 6 and 60, and then we talk about best practice and the fact that children need to stay in booster seats until they fit correctly into the adult lap shoulder belts. We also conduct a national standardized child passenger safety training to certify people as child passenger safety technicians. We have over 400 technicians throughout the state of Oregon. When we train them in best practice. So these 400 people are also out there spending a great deal of time educating parents and grandparents about the importance of keeping their children in booster seats past our current regulation of 6 and 60. The need for for seats for our families who are lower income, we have a program in almost every county in the state where we try to fund access to seats at a reduced cost. We always have higher demand than we have seats available. So being able to increase access to seats for families would be a wonderful opportunity as well. So please consider the staff at ACTS Oregon as a resource for you. We are a staff of 5, and all 4 of us are certified technicians and instructors. So we can answer any questions that you may have, and our contact information is in my testimony. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay. Welcome.
Hello, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Tammy Franks. I am the Child Passenger Safety Coordinator for Legacy Health System and Quality Healthcare, as well as a Child Passenger Safety Technician Instructor. But most importantly, I'm a concerned citizen and mother of 2 booster seat age children. I'm here today to talk to you as that mother and share my personal story with you. As we've told you today, studies show that use of booster seats lowers the risk of injury to children in crashes by 59% compared to the use of vehicle seat belts. In 2004, my family was involved in a severe crash where both vehicles were totaled. A 4-door sedan rear-ended our minivan at 55 miles an hour while we were stopped waiting to make a turn just 0.3 miles from our destination. My son, who at that time was 6.5 years of age, 50 inches, and 56 pounds, and my daughter was 4 years old and 40 pounds. Both children were using a belt positioning booster in the rear seats of the minivan. After the doors of the minivan were pried open by the emergency responders, both of the children walked away. They were traumatized but uninjured from the crash, and I had them to say goodbye to them this morning when I came down here. If we had been following the child occupant protection law in the state where the crash occurred, both children could have been legally using the improperly fitting vehicle seat belts and could have been seriously injured. I'm lucky that working as a child passenger safety technician since 1999 has allowed me to be fully acquainted with Oregon's child occupant protection law, as well as the American Academy of Pediatrics best practice transportation guidelines. I have attached the American Academy of Pediatrics policy, which is entitled Selecting and Using the Most Appropriate Car Safety Seat for Growing Children, Guidelines for Counseling Parents, for your reference. And you'll see there that the American Academy of Pediatrics does recommend that children should use a belt positioning booster until the vehicle safety belt fits well, approximately 4 feet 9 inches. For the safety of Oregon's children, I encourage you to support Senate Bill 480, thus adopting the AAP's best transportation guidelines as Oregon law, help protect the other children for parents who need that advice so they can be as fortunate as I was that day. Thank you very much for your time and consideration to this matter. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for coming. Does Trauma Nurses Talk Tough still exist?
Yes, we do.
Good.
Yes, we That's do over... I was trying to figure it out. We do about 130 safety belt classes alone every year, as well as about 500 school presentations. So
great. You do a lot of good work, and thank you so much for coming on this bill.
Thank you very much.
Questions from the committee? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair Burdick.
Okay. Troy Costellas and Dr. Mel Cohn. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Council Stanford. My name is Troy Costellas, Administrator of the Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 480, as mentioned, mirrors some of the U.S. Department of Transportation best practices for motor vehicle occupant protection, for specifically dealing with young children. The U.S. Department of Transportation's National Highway Traffic Safety Administration typically is the lead agency relating to safety and occupant safety and looked at for technical guidance as well as funding. In 2002, based on the 2001 session, Oregon put in the booster seat bill effective January 1, 2002. Since that time, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has changed their recommendations twice. So the bill before you today, Senate Bill 480, comes into compliance or lines up with the latest recommendations from the U.S. Department of Transportation for children and booster seats. From the safety division point of view, we do a lot of mass media effort. We do a lot of training. We help sponsor, as some of the speakers prior talked about, the technician training as well as the clinics, as well as the availability of seats for low or no income families. One of the sections in the bill is what will qualify Oregon for a brand new set of funding that was created by Congress a year and a half ago that allows us to use the booster seat funding to be able to do technician training, to be able to do events, to be able to do outreach, as well as to purchase seats for low or no income families to make them available around the state. The Dash 2 and Dash 4 amendments as presented to you do not interfere with the comparison of Oregon law with the federal law in relationship to securing the federal highway safety funds, which is approximately $500,000 per year that we would be able to use at least for the next 2 years, once this biennium and 1 year of next biennium. And booster seats, as mentioned earlier, do make a difference. Both my children also graduated from infant seats to car seats to booster seats, and make sure that they wear the belt properly, and didn't realize the car would start unless they had their belts on. So that was my part, making sure that my kids were safe, as Ms. Franks had talked about with her children as well. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you may have as far as the department and our fiscal impact statement relating to this bill.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you. Dr. Cohn.
Members of the committee, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division at the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify in favor of this bill. I'm not going to repeat what's already been said. I just want to stress 2 points. The first is that motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death for children in the age range of 4 to 8 years old. And so this bill is putting in place a proven method of reducing those deaths, and that's why we are in support of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from committee? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just curiosity, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mel, in your testimony, you say that since 2001, 23 children ages 4 to 8 died as occupants in motor vehicle crashes. How many adults died in those crashes? Because it gets to a matter of severity of the crash, obviously, as well. So do you have that statistic?
Chair Burdick, Senator Cruz, I don't have that answer for you off the top of my head, but I'll be happy to get that for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can I in part address Senator Cruz's question relating to the adult size?
Okay.
Relationship to, we do have a mandatory seatbelt law as voted in by the general public in Oregon, so all adults are supposed to be in safety belts based on the vote of the people. Yet, on average, for the past 4 years, on average, 117 adults are killed in traffic crashes not wearing their seatbelts. And we know based on just the lap belt itself is about 50% effective, reducing death and injury, lap and shoulder between 65 and 67%. So just if we can get the last 4 or 5% of people not wearing belts in the state to wear belts, we would see an adult life saved of somewhere between 50 and 60 per year.
Just follow up, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, but number one, the statistic doesn't reference whether those children were in protective restraints or not, and number two, there are some accidents that no matter how protected you are, you're not going to walk away from. So I'm just trying to get kind of a sense of scope.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
All right. Senator Beyer.
Troy, just a question, I guess. I'm trying to get my arms around this bill now with these two amendments that have been presented. Under the current law, I'm looking at Section 4 of the bill, top of page 2, lines 12 through 15. It says a person who's under 4 years of age and weighs 40 pounds or less must be properly secured by a child safety system that meets the minimum standards and specifications established by the Department of Transportation, you guys. So I'm assuming by that language you have adopted rules and state what these minimum specifications are.
That is accurate. We have adopted rules that point towards either the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards Act or the USDOT standards in relationship to the manufacturer's details of booster seats, car seats, and infant seats.
Okay, follow up, Madam Chair?
Please.
Thank you. So I'm trying to get my handles around this new section being added above that that talks about regardless of weight, person. If they're 1 year's or age or less, or 20 pounds or less, no matter how old they are, they would have to be facing rear. Do your standards that you have adopted already say that children, infants have to be rear facing?
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, the current standards aren't going to get into that area because it's not current law. Our best practices and recommendation is for infants to be seated in a rear seating position and not where there is a potential airbag that would impede upon the area where the rear seating position is. So it's an education, it's a best practice, it's a recommendation, but without it being in law, you're not going to see a standard or something that potentially could be cited because it's not current law.
Clarification, Madam Chair.
Please say that.
The section below talks about for anyone who's under 4 years of age or 40 pounds, and it gives you the authority to set minimum standards and specifications. So doesn't that give you the authority by administrative rule to adopt a standard that says that children who are under the age of, who meet this age and weight test above, could adopt those standards?
Madam Chair and Senator Beyer, the standards are on the actual seat itself. It's not on the use or positioning of the seat.
Senator, are you asking whether they could expand the scope of the regulations under existing law?
Yeah, I'm asking if they have the authority under this law that we currently have to adopt a rear-facing. It seems to me, the language seems pretty clear, that they have the authority to adopt minimum standards and specifications. It seems to me like they have authority to do that under current law.
Madam Chair, Senator Byrd, I have to ask the question. We've not approached it from the ability to try and say how it would be positioned or an age limit as much as saying there are federal standards out there in relationship to being crash tested and what the specs that the seats and the devices that are being used, what they must meet. So that's a question I can't answer today. I'd have to ask to see if this particular area and statute gives us that authority or not.
So your answer is you don't know whether you have that authority.
I'd have to check. Thank you.
Senator Pozanski?
Well, I was just going to follow up on that. I mean, it sounds like maybe that's the answer we're going to get. I mean, I agree with Senator Beyer. If you're looking at the text of the statute right now, it says that any child who is under that age or that weight must be properly secured with the minimum standards and specifications as we have established through the ODOT under RS 815055. So it seems that they could have multiple standards depending on the weight, the size of the child, etc., depending on what the situation is, as compared to whether we need to explicitly put something in that says this will be required under as proposed on lines 9 through 11.
Have any comment on that?
I still have to ask to see, to verify whether we have the authority to do the age and the position.
Okay. All right. And Senator Beyer, from your question, were you saying that you would prefer to have it done by administrative rule rather than by statute?
Well, Madam Chair, I was just trying to get clarification because, I've seen agencies go way out on limbs and adopt rules that they may or may not have the authority to do, but it seems like in this case they have clear authority to do it, and that's why I just wanted to know if they had it by rule today, and if they don't, why. The question I would have of counsel, Madam Chair, and I recognize Darian is not, this isn't normally his bill, but When you get to the what is currently subsection B of subsection 2 of that section, so you're down line 16 through 25, under current law, a person, and this was changed in 01 if I remember right, but a person who is between the age of 4 and 6 and weighs between 40 and 60 pounds, or 40 and 60 pounds, so it's either one of those, they have to be in a restraint system. It's not, because when this law was passed, I remember the confusion greatly after it, because I was actually one of the few no votes in the assembly against it, but because people thought that when they got to a certain weight or a certain age, they would be beyond the restrictions. But this law, the way it reads, is that they have to do both. Is that correct? They have to meet...
Question is about existing law.
Existing law.
Yes.
No, either one, as I read it.
No, it's both.
Who is at least, as I read it, just looking at the plain text, a person who is at least 4 years of age and under 6 years of age.
Or
so between 4 and 6, or weighs between 40 and 60 pounds.
So if they're either one of those, yes, they have to be in a safety.
Mm-hmm. Either or, correct.
Because under, yeah, that was confusing, because people at the time, I think they were mistaken. They thought they were voting for either age 6 or 60 pounds, whichever comes first, and that's not the case.
That's which comes second.
It's which comes second, because I remember the debate was there were many people, young, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-olds who are very small people who don't get that 60-pound weight limit, and they're still in safety restraint systems. The way this is drafted now, if this was to pass when you put in a height test, is this again going to be or is this, and so if a person is more than 40 pounds and 4 feet 9 inches shorter, is it that or 8 years old? So they have to again meet both tests as this is drafted, or is it going to be either, is it going to be in whichever comes first, not whichever comes second?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer, I see this as my first read as you're looking at one thing here, more than 40 and under 4'9". And the 8 years old deal does not apply. As a quick read of this bill, I see it as classifying children, and please, Mr. Costales, correct me if I'm misstating this, because this is on a very quick read. This bill would propose the following categories for Oregon children: under age 1 or equal to or under 20 pounds. That's one category. So either one. I have my boy's 15 months and he's 19 pounds, so he's rear facing.
Correct.
So either one of those. That's category 1. Category 2 is greater than or equal to 40 pounds.
Correct.
No age, no nothing. Just greater than or equal to 40 pounds is category 2. You have certain requirements. Category 3 is greater than 40 pounds, but also 4'9" or shorter. Both of those. So you're over 40 pounds, but you're also 4'9" or shorter. Those are, I'll call them category 3 children. Category 4 is you're over 4'9". Category 5 is you're 8 or older. Am I missing something?
No, Chair. Council Stanford, I'd say the last three are grouping together.
They're subject to the same.
Correct.
They're different ways of getting
Correct.
The same requirement, but I can meet... my understanding is you're wearing a seatbelt, basically, when you get to that point. You're kind of treated as an adult.
Correct.
So if I'm 8 or older... Or if I'm 5, but I'm 5'11", that's where I fit.
That's correct.
Okay.
Then as a graduated from infant seat, car seat, booster seat, seat belt.
Okay, so if you have a 60-pound kid who is, weighs more than 40 pounds, a 41-pound kid who is 4'9½", then that would be in a would be okay.
That'd be seatbelt, right?
Yep.
But how about if it's a 41-pound kid who's 4'8"?
Yeah, 40-pound kid who's 41-pound kid who's 4'8". I guess he'd be in the
seat.
In the seat, in the booster seat.
What if he's 5'4" and weighs 39 pounds?
Then
he's sick. Take him out.
Children's services will be able to take care of that one, Senator Cruz.
Really skinny.
Okay. Were these particular requirements, what kind of medical and technical input went into these particular requirements? The 40 pounds, 4'9", those kinds of requirements. Dr. Cohen, maybe you could address that.
Yes, Chair Burdick. These follow the guidelines, the nationally promulgated guidelines, for example, from the American Academy of Pediatrics about restraint use.
Okay. And there, and you just kind of superimposed the federal requirements. There was no unique state involvement in this.
Senator Burdick, no, I do not believe so.
Okay. Senator Pusansky.
I guess I want to follow up on what Senator Beyer was questioning as to this being done through administrative rule. But one of the questions I guess I'd have, it seems to me that it may be, let's say, not only more simple to do it through administrative rule, but it also would allow for flexibility. Once we put these type of requirements into the statute, if there is another finding that comes out and says, no, that's not right, it should be a different standard or a different means of addressing these concerns for safety, it would be quicker to be able to do that through administrative rule process than waiting to get us back in session. So I really am curious as to where the department is as to what authority they currently have and whether or not it would be more advantageous for the safety of children to have this done through administrative rule instead of us putting specifics in statute that could become outdated based on new studies or findings in the future.
Or alternatively, to put in specifics and then give specific authority to the agency to make changes if necessary. I mean, give them a specific rule authority, because the way I understand it, there's some uncertainty as how far that rulemaking authority goes.
Well, that's what we're going to find out.
If it's helpful, I can. Here's the statute. I can read it.
Okay.
Council. Mr. Costales and Chair Burdick, I was just looking at the grant of authority to ODOT under 815.055. And if it's useful, rules establishing standards for safety belts, harnesses, and child safety systems, subsection 1. The Department of Transportation shall adopt and enforce rules establishing minimum standards and specifications for the construction and installation of safety belts, safety harnesses, or child safety systems and anchors, or other devices to which safety belts, safety harnesses, or child safety systems may be attached and secured. And then the rules adopted under this subsection are subject to the following. In sum, it says conform to federal standards. The rules that establish minimum standards and specifications for child safety systems required and regulated under this section, blah, blah, shall conform to the standards for child safety systems established by the federal government. Child safety systems are required to meet those standards in effect at the date of manufacture.
But it really doesn't talk about placement, which is what this bill talks about.
Uses the word installation.
And doesn't talk about who.
Installation to me would be, you know, how you attach it to the... I mean, you may be right. Do you have any...
Well, Madam Chair, just was looking at that as well, that section. There are seats that can be forward as well as rearward installed. And the part where I'm curious as to is whether we can do, and I think Senator Beyer was looking specifically at this whole one-year age being rearward, can we do that by rule? Does it need to be in statute? Installation of a seat guideline would be according to manufacturer standards of how they tell you how to use it. So I don't know if we're going to have the authority to turn around and say, and then if your child or the child in the seat is under one, you've got to install it rearward versus forward. I don't know if this is enough authority to get us to that particular spot that I think Senator Beyer was asking about, is the one-year reverse versus forward seating spot. And I wouldn't want to try and put something in a rule that then would be also unenforceable and be more of a best practice recommendation, which is generally what we do now in the mass media efforts.
Madam Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I would love to get rid of this. What this is attempting to do in this bill is this: the or between 4 and 6 years of age or 40 or 60 pounds, because that has been unclear and confusing for citizens since it was adopted when I think it was 01. But the way I read this as it's laid out now, we go from clear as mud to clear as chocolate pudding. It really isn't an improvement. And, you know, I think if we're going to do something like this, I would prefer, as Senator Brzezinski said, let's talk about what we desire and give them rulemaking authority to do it and try to keep the statute clear, because this is just so confusing. People don't understand what the current law is today on children between 4 and 6 years old and 40 and 60 pounds, and they won't understand if we pass this as drafted between more than 40 pounds, under 40 pounds, who's 4'9", what does a 4'8", 39-pounder do versus a 4'8", 41-pounder do. It just makes it more confusing than it is today. So I guess my suggestion is, if we're going to go down this road, we would try to make it clear, or just give the department the authority to do it by rule and instruct them to do it clearly so people know what it means.
Senator Devlin has come back. I don't know how much of this you caught, Senator Devlin, but Senator Beyer and Senator Brzezinski were raising the issue of how much of this could be accomplished by rulemaking rather than putting it into the statute.
Well, in statute we have the six or 60. And I don't believe that they could expand it beyond statute by rule. I think part of the confusion here is our discussion has been on infant seats and booster seats, and we've forgotten somehow of the existing law on normal child restraint systems, which is a normal child restraint seat, which is normally for a child up to age 4, I believe, and under 40 pounds. That's existing law, and the 6 and 60 is existing law. If I was a law enforcement officer, and we didn't bring the full contingent here today because we brought the full contingent to the House, I would explain this very simply. If a child is under 1, they have to be in a rear-facing seat designed for an infant. If a child is under 4, 40 pounds, they have to be in a normal child restraint system, which has been the law, I believe, since the 1970s. If a child is over those weights up until the age of 8, they have to be in a booster seat unless they happen to be over 4'9". That is probably the easiest way to explain it, and that is actually, once you do all these amendments, that's basically what's left in the law. I think the confusion here is between the existing law, the number of times that we're actually amending the bill that's before you, because we're taking out those areas that people had the most concern about, which actually I had some concerns about when it was first in the bill, which was, I think, a little bit overreaching, to be honest, that 12-year-olds had to automatically sit in the back seat. Because I think that issue, we had really broad discussion of that in the House.
Okay, let's not focus on that. Let's just focus on what the bill is trying to do now, because that hasn't been discussed. So, okay, I think what we should do here is continue to work for more clarity on what we're trying to do here, and maybe explore ways that we could put some of it in rule. You'd have an objection to that?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm not so sure that a rule can expand beyond current law.
Well, we're talking about potentially changing it. This has an excellent
relating clause. Authority.
The relating clause will let us give whatever power we need to give our authority. My concern, Senator, is that once we put these in statute, that's the law. And if there's some new safety provisions that come out, we have no flexibility of changing that unless we come back to the legislature. And so it seems to me that if we're looking for safety and making sure we're staying on top of it, we should have some flexibility to allow for the department to be able to implement rules that we make certain we don't keep kids in vulnerable positions that may turn out to be at risk.
Madam Chair, I think that is a good intent. My question would be, is Would you want me to go and draft an amendment like that? Because I can tell you quite honestly that I think that there are also people out there who would have concerns if we drafted an amendment like that, giving the department broad authority to, by rule, determine what child restraint system they should have. And I would also say that if that is not the intent, then basically you're not changing the existing law, and we're waiting probably 2 or 3 years to comply with the new federal requirements.
Senator Cruz?
If I could ask Senator Devlin a question,
because
I was late getting here because I was Bill Fisher's in my office, and that takes time, as we all know. But the testimony I did hear, it seems that people are speaking more to the size of the child rather than the age of the child as far as what is appropriate. So, I mean, for example, my stepdaughter is 6 years old and still not as big as I am, but getting close. So so I'm wondering if they're size appropriate. Shouldn't that be the key in this rather than being age driven?
That's true. We actually discussed these items in great detail, but you can look at it in the reverse too. The issue that people have with 6 or 60 is you obviously do have a few children that are probably 11, 12 years old and still have not gotten to 60 pounds.
Right.
And so it comes from both directions. And I think what we were trying to do here is to make it easily enforceable so that it would be at 8, which is easy for law enforcement to enforce. But for the rare child who is actually out there and who is over 4'9" at 8 years of age, or 7 years of age, I should say, they would no longer be under the law because they are of a size where they would be adequately protected in a normal seat, normal lap belt and shoulder harness.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe I'm just dense on this. I'm trying to figure out how age will be easier for law enforcement to enforce unless I'm carrying a birth certificate. How is a cop going to know by looking at that child how old that child is? It would be easier for them to determine on site the approximate height and weight of the child.
To some degree, but in our testimony in the House, the law enforcement officer there from the Portland Police Bureau spoke quite eloquently to having this as simple as possible, and spoke in support of the changes in the booster seat law. I think you can do it either way, but it doesn't take away complexity. Because I just think that what we're trying to do is to protect the vast majority of children in these circumstances. And if you try to define something so clearly in terms of height and weight, then you're going to have law enforcement officers out there with tape measures and scales.
Okay. At this point, we've got a full agenda, people from out of town, so I'm going to close the public hearing on this and ask Senator Devlin and Senator Pozanski to work together and with input from Senator Beyer. And I do intend to move a bill on this one way or the other. And let's just make sure that, and it may be the -2 and the -4 do it, but let's make sure that we have it as clear as possible and go the direction we all want to go. So I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 480, and we will bring it back. Okay, we're going to open a very brief work session on Senate Bill 555, which is what we affectionately call in this building a gut and stuff. And Senator Beyer, actually, counsel, why don't you start off by saying everything you know on this?
Thank you, Chair Burdick.
Except you don't know anything. Our other counsel is here. Senator Beyer, why don't we just bypass counsel and you start on this?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. Thank you. There's Bill now. Madam Chair, Senate Bill 555, and I would like to direct your attention to the -3 amendments that are hopefully in front of you. They were supposed to have been handed out by the committee staff. The issue is We have less than 2 dozen fish hatcheries in the state of Oregon, private fish hatcheries, and the information that they are required to give to the Department of Fish and Wildlife in order to transport these fish to their customers is a public record. And we have other fish hatcheries have interest in those customer lists and being able to basically cherry pick the customer list and then try to supplement their own fish hatcheries. So the intent of this amendment would be to make the customer information, unless a public interest requires the closure, we would make the name, home address, professional address, electronic mail address, telephone and fax numbers of the person who receives the fish, so it's the customer. We would like to exempt that from public records so that their competitors, quite honestly, could not go to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and get their customer information.
Now, Senator Barr, is this, how many hatcheries would be affected by this?
Madam Chair, I don't have the exact number, but there's less than 2 dozen. It's very few. The Section 2 of the amendment is a sunset, and in discussions with some potential opponents to public record exemptions, they talked about trying to do a comprehensive look of all the exemptions to the public record law in the interim. And I'm fine with doing that look, but the problem you have is that that would mean any potential fix would be 2.5 years out. And this would give that group of small group of fish hatcheries who are, you know, already struggling under regulations and laws and everything else in the state a 2.5 year or until my anticipation, if we did that look, and by some chance we have a special session next February and a bill is ready to go on public record exemptions, we could repeal this section at that time with a new bill. And in the absence of that, this exemption would be in place until January 1st of 2010, which would mean that would be any law changed by the 2009 legislature. That's when it would go into effect. It would be January 1st of 2010. So that would be the purpose of that sunset.
Okay, so basically, so all these fish hatcheries are going after each other's lists, is that it?
Well, Madam Chair, what really happened was there was a new fish hatchery started that went after all the rest of their lists in order to develop a customer base.
Oh.
So that is the purpose of the amendment, Madam Chair, and I know that there are people here probably from the newspaper industry who aren't thrilled with another exemption, and if you'd like them to speak on it, it's up to you, Madam Chair.
I would very briefly, is Tom Gallagher and Sarah, did you want to come? Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, yes, I'm Tom Gallagher representing the newspaper publishers. I understand the purpose behind this bill, and I appreciate the way the amendments were drafted, so just that the customer list, not all of the information that's carried on one of the transport permits, which look like this. I want to make just three quick comments on this. I've been in front of this committee in the last couple of years 3 times supporting exemptions to public records. One was for the State Health Division to protect organ donations and going back and investigating organ donations to find out where they had an infected organ and where it came from and protecting the liability of the institutions that were involved. I've been here supporting an amendment to protect police officers who criminals were going into their public records, finding the police officers' home addresses and driving over to their home and harassing the members of the police family. And I've been here supporting an exemption for OHSU for primates because of the activities that some of the protesters were doing to unrelated third parties well down the road. So the newspapers are supportive of exemptions when there's a balancing test and a balancing factor that says there's a very good public reason to protect these people. There are hundreds of records like these fish hatcheries that state agencies collect, that competitors look to, lists that are compiled. There are other kinds of public records like permits and so forth in DEQ that the general public, especially the environmental public, accesses to use for purposes of investigation, purposes of collecting information and general information. There are hundreds of public records out there that somebody could come in and say, I don't want these to go because they affect my business. For one new fish hatchery to come in and get smart enough to go in and look for the other people, my general business knowledge says you compete on quality, price, and relationships. And those things still exist among all the people that sell to the fish hatchery. Just to quickly summarize and say, I would very much like to support your amendment, Senator Beyer. I don't see that the public, in general, benefits from this exemption to the public record. Just a small number of fish hatchery people who eliminate a particular competitive advantage or disadvantage. I'd be happy to answer questions, but thank you for the time.
Thank you. Michael, why don't you go in there and we'll see if I have questions. Be very brief, please.
I will. Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the Judiciary Committee. Michael Mason, I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs. We have not had time to take a position on the amendment, and I can't say for sure what that would be. I can tell you that the tribes have labored for decades to develop a good working relationship with the Department of Fish and Wildlife from what started as a very, very bitter relationship, and with the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we now have a positive relationship. So as I'm just here to ask for a little time. I've been on the phone trying to reach the tribal attorneys and folks at the Green River Intertribal Fish Commission to find out if this would have an impact on our relationship with Fish and Wildlife and make things more difficult in the ongoing protracted U.S. v. Oregon litigation. So we are just concerned about it and would ask that we have a little more time to comprehend it, not having seen it until this morning.
Okay, thank you. Senator Beyer, did you want to add anything?
Well, Madam Chair, I guess the issue with the Confederate Tribes is new to me, and appreciate you getting back to me as soon as you can. I guess the newspaper publishers, you know, there are other exemptions currently under current law about copyright information, protected information, business information, and in fact, like commercial fishermen, their records are exempt because it is considered proprietary information under current law. And we're not asking for anything, but if the state of Oregon requires private entities to turn customer lists over to them, it seems ridiculous. We then also require that state agency to provide that customer list to any of the competitors. It'd be like making lobbyists turn over their customer lists and letting other lobbyists access that in order to go troll it, you might say.
Actually, they are on file publicly, Senator Beyer. That may not be the best example.
Maybe a good amendment, Senator Beyer. Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I have a letter from the Department of Justice that the agency requested as to whether or not they could keep these records private under trade secrets, which is what you're talking about here. The trade secrets section is often used, and it's to protect certain kinds of the Coke formula, the special sauce for the McDonald's hamburgers and so forth, those kinds of things. This is just a customer list. This is just people who you're selling to. So I appreciate that.
Okay. Well, this amendment that we have isn't even, it doesn't accomplish what you wanted to accomplish anyway. Correct?
Actually, it does. The Dash 3 was just redrafted.
Oh, yeah. I see. This is hot off the press.
Yes. Okay. Came out this morning.
All right. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 555, and we'll, because of witnesses' time constraints, start open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1009. And change councils again. Thank you, Mr. Taylor.
Senate Bill 1009. Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 1009 modifies the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission's method of calculating criminal history in consecutive sentences in certain circumstances. Oregon presently uses a criminal history scale, often referred to as the sentencing grid, which I'm holding a copy of in my hand, to calculate the presumptive sentences for felony offenders. In short, the vertical axis, which has the numbers 1 through 11, corresponds to the seriousness of the current crime, and the horizontal axis, A through I, corresponds to the defendant's prior record. I, the least serious category, means essentially no criminal history, whereas A, the most serious, means three or more prior person felonies. Senate Bill 1009 modifies the Commission's rules, which are presently found at Oregon Administrative Rule 213004-0006, for calculating a defendant's standing on the horizontal axis, meaning the A through I designation. Presently, a defendant's history is based on the number of prior convictions at the time the new crime is sentenced. A conviction is considered to have occurred upon the pronouncement of a sentence in open court. Senate Bill 1009 provides that a defendant's criminal history cannot include prior convictions that were or could have been joined in the defendant's present trial under ORS 132.560 sub B. Let me state that more accurately. It doesn't mean that all the prior convictions are thrown out if they could have been joined. It means that it just counts as one prior conviction, whatever the most serious offense was. It further provides, Senate Bill 1009 does, that multiple previous convictions count only as a single conviction if the previous convictions were or could have been joined for trial. And I'll talk for a second then about what the rules of joinder are. ORS 132.560 sub B provides that two or more offenses may be charged in the same charging instrument. Charging instruments are generally informations for misdemeanors or grand jury indictments for felonies. You can charge two or more offenses in the same charging instrument if the offenses were committed by the same person and they were either one of the same or similar character, two based on the same act or transaction, or three based on two or more acts connected together as part of an overall plan. For example, suppose a defendant picks up a driving under the influence of intoxicants Dewey charge, and then 6 months later picks up a second Dewey charge, or 6 months or 1 year or 2 years later, there's no real time limitation, without resolving the first Dewey. What could happen then is the state could move to join or consolidate those two Dewey counts, because they're of the same or similar character, into a single trial. If that same defendant then also picked up a delivery of methamphetamine or charged like that, the state would likely not be able to join that count because delivery of methamphetamine is not necessarily, quote, of the same character as what a Dewey charge is. Finally, Senate Bill 1009 provides that the Commission's rule limiting the length of consecutive sentences applies to crimes, again, that were or could have been joined for trial under ORS 132. Those rules about consecutive sentences are established at OAR 213-012-0010 to 0040.
Okay. Mark Blackman. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mark Blackman from Portland, appearing here on behalf of the OCDLA. The purpose of this bill is to return the criminal history calculation process under the sentencing guidelines to what it was when the guidelines were first implemented by the legislature in 1989. Counsel for the committee has already held up the sentencing grid. I won't go through that again, assuming you're somewhat familiar with the way the system works. But currently, the presumptive sentence that someone is to receive upon conviction is based in part on the seriousness of the offense, which is one axis, and the criminal history of that person, which is the other axis. Under the original guideline system that was the result of much study by the legislature and committees created by the legislature, the criminal history was determined based on real-world conduct and real-world experience. And that's what resulted in the rule that is commonly known as the single judicial proceeding rule. The idea is that, you know, we've got a book of laws that is an inch and a half thick. It gets thicker every time you guys meet, which identifies the elements of specific offenses unrelated to the course of conduct that results in the possible prosecution. Under the original guideline structure, offenses that could have been joined because they were part of the same act or transaction or resolve it involving the same nature of offenses were considered a single matter for purposes of determining what is this person's criminal history. In other words, what kind of person is the court facing? Is this someone who has failed to learn a lesson? Or is this someone who has been before the court only once before, or maybe only twice before? And the original rule, which is the rule used by the federal courts, which I will say are no slouches when it comes to doling out punishment, looks at not how many statutes did this course of conduct violate, but how many times did this person engage in a course of conduct that brought him before a court that found that he was guilty and needed to impose a sanction. Under the original structure of the guidelines and under the current federal guidelines, if that person had been before the court just once before, that person would have that single criminal history point. Or if that person was before the court for the first time but on multiple counts, and as I hope you understand, the number of counts that a person is facing in a prosecution is really a matter of the imagination of the prosecution. It is not a matter of the analysis of the real-world conduct. That person coming before the court for the first time is treated the same whether that person is technically convicted of a single offense or convicted of multiple offenses, because it's the first time that person is before the court. Under the revised criminal history rules that were adopted about 5 years after the guidelines went into effect, the same person with the same history, the person who is before the court for the first time, who cuts a deal to plead to one count, is subject to a criminal history category I because they have no prior criminal history. If that person, if another person with the exact same course of conduct is charged in five counts, then under our current rules, they're category I on count one, but they're category, depending on the nature of the offense, H on count two, F on count three, E on count four, and possibly B or C on count five. Totally arbitrary, totally artificial, totally unrelated to the nature of the conduct that brought the person before the court. And so all that this bill attempts to do is recapture the nature of the conduct in the real world, not the way it can be parsed out by someone's study of the criminal code, in informing the court about what criminal history, what actual history of engagement in criminal conduct the person before the court has experienced. And we believe that this will, in fact, bring the system of determining criminal history back into relationship of reality as opposed to technicality. And primarily, what it will do is for the person who is before the court for the first time, it will level the playing field. And candidly, people who are before the court for the first time are a different quality of person than the person who's before the court a second or a third or a fourth time. And under this bill, the person who's before the court the second, third, or fourth time is treated sequentially more severely. But the person before the court for the first time is treated the same whether or not they've been convicted of a single specific incident or specific offense or a variety of offenses arising out of the same act or transaction.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. We will now move to Ms. Brad Berry and Tim Sylvester.
Excuse me. Before I leave, I want to leave the table. I do want to say I may need to leave before the hearing on this matter concludes, and it's not because I'm not interested. It's just because I have some other commitments in Portland.
Okay. I think you'll probably still be here because I want them to be very brief, and they've promised they will.
I know Mr. Berry for many years.
Okay.
And brief is my middle name.
Thank you. Welcome. We are running out of time, and there's an out-of-town person I want to take on the next bill, so please.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Brad Berry. I'm the Amhill County District Attorney. I, too, chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I've got an outline here of things, and I can go through this fairly quickly to show you, I think, the problems with and why we oppose Senate Bill 1009. If I can, in just a few seconds, give you a little history on sentencing, as Mr. Blackman did. The guidelines were adopted in 1989 with certain goals in mind. Two of those were predictability of sentencing and consistency of sentencing throughout the state. As it was before that, a judge in my county, for example, may give 5 years on a burglary too, and somebody in Malheur County might put somebody on probation. There wasn't consistency, and by design it was to have the same type of offense with the same or similar criminal background. You got the same predictable sentence from the sentencing guidelines. Two, before the adoption of the guidelines, Department of Corrections really had the authority over how much time anybody served, because at the time there was no room at the inn. If you got 5 years, you went in, and it was up to the parole board to decide how much time somebody actually served. Senate Bill 1000, well, then in 1989, the guidelines were adopted. In 93, they were changed to allow for sentencing as it is today. And Mr. Blackman talked a little bit about how it was in 1989. It was 1993 that allows for both the consecutive sentencing, as we've talked about, or is provided for in Section 3, as well as how somebody moves across the grid for prior offenses. Senate Bill 1009 not only would change that, but does two things. One, changes how the criminal history is counted, looking at a single judicial proceeding rather than the number of offenses and types of offenses which have been committed, and also would allow the defense to argue what could have been charged at the same time. So using an example similar to Mr. Blackman's, you pick up a PCS on January 1, you pick up another one on February 1, you ultimately resolve it on March 1, but lab test comes back from a February 15th case, comes back on April 1, it could be argued those all could have been handled at the same time, one judicial proceeding. I note that the Dash 1 amendments that are here would also require the state to prove, have the burden of proof of what could have been not have been handled in a single proceeding. In an effort to be brief, let me show you just how far awry Senate Bill 1009 could go. First, and let's assume that we have an offender who commits a sexual abuse on his 6-year-old stepdaughter repeatedly over a 2-year period. He too sexually offends against a 5-year-old neighbor and a 7-year-old neighbor on the other side. He rapes his 10-year-old stepdaughter. All of these offenses come to light at the same time and are charged through multiple counts in an offense. We now have an offender who's charged with sex offenses against 4 separate victims, charged in a single indictment. He could be tried in a single trial on all of those. And Senate Bill 1009 would say that when he comes back before the court sometime off in the future, that he would be treated as if he had one single conviction for the purposes of the grid, regardless of having 4 separate victims, regardless of having types of conduct that differed against 4 separate victims, because the joinder statutes allow all of those to be put before a single jury or brought before the court on a single indictment. This would gut the premise of predictable sentencing and consistent sentencing, because if that same offender raped or sexually abused his 5-year-old daughter in his home, took the 7-year-old neighbor to Lincoln City to go camping and sexually abused her, rapes his 10-year-old daughter at an outing with the church in Marion County, and those were charged, they would by law have to be charged in 3 separate jurisdictions. The same conduct over a similar period of time would now end up being 3 separate convictions and would avoid the consistency for the exact same conduct from the exact same type of offender. This would be the same in property offenses. If someone burglarized a Salem home, stole credit cards and the like, again, if they went next door back to their own home, used the credit cards and the internet, committed ID theft and theft, and had the burglary, all of those could be brought together in Marion County. If, however, they took the credit cards to Albany, they went home to Polk County and did things on the internet, again, we have the same conduct, but would significantly differ how their grid calculation would be in the future because of how Senate Bill 1009 would treat them.
Let me just ask you, the point was made that this is how the federal guidelines work, and they're not noted for being particularly soft on on criminals. What is your comment to that?
Well, Senator Burdick, I might thank you for the question. I might point out that the federal sentences are significantly steeper than the sentences in Oregon. The grid and that Mr. Blackman showed you, and everybody I know is familiar with it here, the sentences that we provide for, especially when it comes to property offenses, are significantly less than similar, although it's hard to say exactly similar because the feds deal with bigger cases. Their sentencing is much greater. Thus, the movement on the grid is not as significant on criminal history. Additionally, the federal guidelines have, and Mr. Blackman could give you more information on this, there are lots of things in the sentencing guidelines in the federal system that are not related to criminal history that move you up or down on the sentencing grid, so unrelated to the criminal history.
Okay. I'm going to cut you off if it's okay, unless there's a big major point there left.
There's lots of, that's fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you have something in writing? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude of other people.
I understand, Chair Burdick. No, I didn't. I just actually prepared an outline so I'd cover things for you.
Okay.
So,
thank you very much. Thank you for your understanding.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I will be extremely brief. Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice, we very, very, very strongly oppose this bill. The whole purpose for over the amendments or the case law that has developed over the last 15 years under the sentencing guidelines has been to have both truth in sentencing and treating similar offenders alike. That is the premise underlying the Oregon Supreme Court decision in State versus Miller and State versus Buchholz that requires treating offenses committed in separate criminal episodes as part of the criminal history. Because otherwise, if you merge them all together, you end up with very, very disparate sentences for similar offenders and very, very similar sentences for offenders who have very different criminal histories. And you can have somebody who goes on a crime spree that affects, as Mr. Berry was mentioning, numerous victims, and if they all merged into a single criminal history score, that results in a very, very artificially low criminal history score for that particular offender when compared with other offenders with much less criminal history.
Okay, is that it?
That's it.
Great, thank you. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your patience. Close the hearing, public hearing on this bill, Senate Bill 1009, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 725 to accommodate Commissioner Gardner. He's still here. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Senate Bill 725. Establishes that discrimination against a person on the basis of disability includes the failure to design and construct a multifamily dwelling as required by the Federal Fair Housing Act and the failure to renovate or modify a building as required by Oregon law designed to provide access to buildings for persons with disabilities. It also establishes that a person may not discriminate against an individual or deny access to a multiple listing service or other real estate broker's organization based on the individual's disability. It prohibits a person from disclosing in the sale, lease, or rental of real property that an occupant or owner either has HIV or has died from AIDS. It establishes procedures for BOLI and property discrimination actions, and it permits actions in circuit court for discrimination in purchase or renting real property.
Okay, Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And I've been asked to say for Senator Carter, who's a sponsor of this bill, that she'd like to be here but is in the DH Rebalancing Committee at the moment. And should you pass this bill out, she'd be very pleased to be the carrier. Senate Bill 725 improves enforcement of federal housing discrimination law and increases local control without spending an additional general fund dollar or state dollars, and it keeps federal dollars in Oregon. What Senate Bill 725 merely allows is reinstating an activity previously handled by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It allowed the Bureau to bolster its ability to serve Oregonians. Senate Bill 725 is supported by the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, Fair Housing Council of Oregon, and the Urban League. At present, the alleging housing discrimination are those alleging housing discrimination are generally referred to the Housing and Urban Development Regional Office in Seattle to file their complaints, and investigation is conducted out of state. As a law enforcement agency with decades of experience, we know that local investigations are more effective and are resolved more quickly. It increases protections for the citizens of the state, and portions of ORS Chapter 659, which is prohibits discrimination in real property on the basis of race, creed, color, sex, marital status, source of income, familial status, religion, national origin, and disability. Federal fair housing laws are similar but not identical to those in state law. The Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development enforces federal law, while the Bureau of Labor and Industries enforces state law. HUD contracts with state governments, and I might comment that they contract with 38 different states out there across the country. As you can see from the chart, there are very few states that are not substantially equivalent currently with the federal law.
Okay, Mr. Gardner, we have your written testimony. Could you just kind of summarize the rest of it?
I will summarize it very quickly, Madam Chair. Basically, in fiscal year 81-82, BOLA used to do this, the federal law exceeded the state limits, and we quit doing the enforcement for it. By passing this bill and making the law substantially equivalent, BOLI could, through contract with the Housing and Urban Development, bring housing discrimination cases back to the state of Oregon. A same bill was passed out of the Senate in 2003 and in 2005. It passed, I believe, last session, 24-4. There is no known opposition to the bill. I appreciate your support.
Thank you very much, and thank you for making your comments brief. Questions from the committee? Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Gardner, you need to come back.
I'm sorry. Come on, Dan.
You don't have to ask a question.
Well, Senator, I was hoping for a slight difference in your attitude, but okay. Just kidding.
I'm consistent in a very inconsistent way. I'm just curious about the prohibition of informing somebody that in a sale or a rental that the previous occupant had AIDS. How's that relevant to anything?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that is within federal law, and it is a requirement under federal law, and we'd have to have it in state statute in order to keep it substantially equivalent. I'd have to go back to the congressional record and find out why they actually put that in federal law.
But this is just, Madam Chair, just conforming to federal law is what that portion is.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's the entire bill with the exception of Section 12, which the Building Codes Division has asked us to delete, and we'd be more than happy to do that in order to keep the bill moving on the House side.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we have Peggy McGuire from the Fair Housing Council here. And do you have prepared testimony?
Yes.
If you could just submit that and then just be extremely brief.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senators, I'm Peggy McGuire. I'm the Executive Director of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. And since you have my written testimony, I'll just share with you a couple of things that aren't in the written testimony so you have a little flavor of what we're working with. The Fair Housing Council of Oregon receives about 4,000 calls a year indicating that people feel they've been discriminated against in a housing transaction. About 400 of those actually turn out to be bona fide allegations of fair housing discrimination. A variety of types of discrimination occur, and I've given you a little cheat sheet on the back page of the handout that gives you some information on some recent cases that we've had. I have worked in the housing industry. I've worked both for a Fair Housing Assistance Program agency, the City of Tacoma, which is the contractual relationship that BOLI is proposing to enter into, and now I'm working in the housing civil rights area. And from all of those perspectives, I'd like to say that the arrangement, the contractual arrangement that the Civil Rights Division could have with HUD for local enforcement of fair housing issues is a great one from every perspective. It's expedient. It allows local investigators to look into housing discrimination issues, and it also allows access for egregious situations for civil rights agencies to access temporary restraining orders to hold housing units available for people who've experienced discrimination. I encourage you to support this proposal, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, and thank you for written testimony and for being brief. Any questions? Okay, thank you. We will close the hearing on this bill. And audience, we're going to put Senate Bill 626 over till Thursday. And my apologies, so that we can take our out-of-town guests on our last bill, which is... Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 627. Council.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Senate Bill 627 expands the existing crime of the invasion of personal privacy to include first and second degree invasions of personal privacy. ORS 163-700 creates the crime of invasion of personal privacy in the following circumstances. Either, one, a person knowingly makes or records a photo, video, etc., of another person in a state of nudity without the person's consent, and this happens when the other person had a reasonable expectation of privacy, or two, for arousing a person's sexual desires, the person is in a location to observe another person in a state of nudity without the consent of the other person, and again, this happens at a location when the other person had a reasonable expectation of privacy. Invasion of personal privacy is a Class A misdemeanor. Senate Bill 627 expands ORS 163.700 in the following ways. First, it redesignates the existing statute as invasion of personal privacy in the second degree, and it adds a third option for when a person installs a recording device to make or record a photo, video, etc. of the other person in a state of nudity without the other person's consent, and again, this recording happens at a place when the other person had a reasonable expectation of privacy. Second change that Senate Bill 627 does, it creates the offense of invasion of personal privacy in the first degree, a Class C felony. This offense occurs when the person commits second-degree invasion of personal privacy, and any one of the following is true. Though there's some confusion about the way legislative counsel drafted this, but Senator Pozanski, I believe it's any one of these following is true. One, the victim is less than 16. Two, the person makes and then knowingly disseminates a photo, video, etc. Or three, the person has a previous conviction for invasion of personal privacy. In any of those situations, the crime would become invasion of personal privacy in the first degree of Class C felony.
Okay, Senator Pozanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. With me today is Detective Dan Brazil, who is with the Eugene Police Department. Dan and I have worked together for many years, and he had brought this to my attention previous to the last session, and I've reintroduced the bill at his request because it's one of these issues that we don't think has been addressed, and there's not current law that's holding individuals accountable to the level they need to. Due to the time constraint that we have, I'm going to ask that the chair go ahead and hear directly from Detective Brazil so he can explain why this is important, why we need or would like to have this move forward.
Thank you very much, and you have our undivided attention.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity to speak in favor of Senate Bill 627. I'd like to start...
Can you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. My name is Dan Brazil. I'm a detective with the Eugene Police Department. I've been with the department for 16 years. My current assignment is in the investigation section where I work in the Violent Crimes Unit. I investigate crimes that involve children and person-to-person felony crimes. I'd like to first indicate that Senator Pozanski, thank you, Senator, introduced this bill at my request, and that though the city didn't ask him to introduce it, they have endorsed this bill, and I have included a letter from the investigations captain indicating that. I'd like to start my testimony by indicating a couple of, or demonstrating a couple of problems in the current invasion of personal privacy statute that have been identified. And I won't read the entire statute, but basically the invasion of personal privacy statute relates to peeping Tom behavior and video voyeurism. It provides that a person commits the crime if they create a visual recording of a person in a state of nudity and that person doesn't give their consent and is in a place and circumstances where they would have a reasonable expectation of privacy. May I have a drink of water, please? Sorry.
If you could just speak up to maybe bring the microphone a little closer.
Thank you. The other part of this statute makes it unlawful for a person to be in a location where they're able to observe a person in a state of nudity, and the person's in a place and circumstance where they have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Thank you. The difficulty with the statute is in subsection 2B, where it defines nudity as uncovered or less than opaquely covered post-pubescent human genitals, pubic areas, or a post-pubescent human female breast below a point immediately above the top of the areola. And nudity includes a partial state of nudity. By that definition, this statute does not apply to a pre-pubescent human being. Therefore, a predator would be able to videotape a child in a state of nudity and not violate this statute. I believe that the legislature in 1997 may have included that definition to allow for an exception for a parent who might videotape their child in a setting such as a bathtub or what any normal person might do in the course of raising a young child. But it creates a problem in that a person who may videotape a child surreptitiously would not violate this statute. I would argue that by removing the definition of post-pubescent, that there is still language in the statute which would allow for a parent to videotape or take a photograph of their child in a state of nudity, because I don't believe, and I think it could be argued, that a child in a bathtub or in a setting where they're nude in their own home is not in a place and circumstance where they would have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, that same child, under those same circumstances, being videotaped by a predator outside their window, by that predator being there, I would argue that that changes the place and circumstances of that child and the nudity. The other problem that I see with the current law is that it only allows for this crime to be a misdemeanor, and that simply isn't proportionate to the level of trauma that it does cause victims. And I'll address more on that in just a moment. The other thing that this law leaves out is it doesn't address the installation of recording equipment. There have been cases in this state where landlords have installed recording equipment in rental houses, and this law simply doesn't address that at this point in time. The other issue is there has been and is continuing a national movement to enact legislation in all states that make this behavior a felony. And I can talk about that more if you need me to at the end of my testimony. Right now, I believe that Oregon is behind the times in this problem. The majority of states do have laws that allow for felony convictions for this type of behavior currently. The reason this became an issue for me was because of a man by the name of William Joseph Green. In 2001, I began an investigation where he had been videotaping people inside their homes. This behavior on his part lasted over a four-year period. We seized dozens and dozens of videotape. There were over 125 victims that ranged in ages between 8 and middle age. There were literally hundreds of hours of videotape that depicted people in extremely embarrassing and personal situations. Mr. Green's behavior progressed to burglaries, where he was breaking into people's homes, videotaping himself engaged in sex acts by himself. He was not a monster. He was a regular person. Everybody thought of him as a very kind, a normal human being who had no other criminal convictions, no other problems with the law. One of his family friends trusted him so much that they allowed their young daughter to be with him alone. Mr. Green ended up taking photographs of that person in suggestive situations and ultimately ended up abusing her sexually. I have included in my written testimony at the back two pages a copy of a piece of evidence that was taken from Mr. Green's home, and I just want to show you this. It's at the back two pages of the written material that I provided. I just wanted to show you this to give you an idea of the scope of this man's behavior. It's a list of addresses, a page and a half long, that includes a description of his victims as well as a letter grade that he assigned these people. I show you that, and then I'd like to tell you that Mr. Green is currently serving a 16-year sentence with the Department of Corrections for his behavior. None of these convictions related to invasion of personal privacy are running consecutively with his burglary and sexual abuse convictions. I can say that all of some of the victims felt very betrayed by the criminal justice system because their victimization wasn't taken into account by the court at that time because this crime was a misdemeanor. I hope I can express the severity of this crime to the victims. I don't know that I can do that because I didn't understand it back before this case came to me. I do now. If you can imagine a young girl in her bedroom doing what normal young girls do, being victimized by a man outside her window, videotaping her, imagine the horror she must feel when she learns this. Imagine a parent's reaction when they realize that they've been unable to protect their children in their own homes, even though they've done every step, everything that they could think of to do that. This crime does affect victims for the rest of their lives. Unlike theft or other misdemeanor crimes, these victims will never forget that they've been victimized, and they may never feel safe in the very place that they should feel safest, their own homes. Madam Chair, I've been in the room with a young victim who found out she'd been victimized by a predator videotaping her in the privacy of her own room. I've seen her curled up in a ball on the floor, unable to speak. I know that that person will be affected by this man for the rest of her life. It is for these reasons that I believe invasion of personal privacy under certain aggravating circumstances should be a felony in the great state of Oregon. If you look at the bill, what this bill proposes to do is remove the post-pubescent language from the definition of nudity. This means that any child would be eligible to be a victim if somebody videotapes them in a state of nudity. It also adds language which means a person, or says a person knowingly installs a recording device for the purpose of making or recording a photograph without that person's consent. And again, that person's in a place and circumstances where they have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And thirdly, it adds a second law, invasion of personal privacy in the first degree, which means that if a person commits the invasion of personal privacy and the victim is less than 16 years of age, it would be a felony. And if the person disseminates that material, it's a felony. And if the person has been convicted of the same crime previously, it's a felony. That's my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer those.
Thank you. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question as to the scope of personal privacy. So I'm assuming that this would not extend, I mean, for example, in a locker room, I suppose one does not have the expectation of personal privacy, but one certainly would have the expectation that they wouldn't be filmed. So would this be able to include that sort of activity, or is it just basically in the home or that sort of situation?
The current language in the statute actually addresses that under the definition of nudity. It's subsection 2C at the top of page 2, line 1. Places and circumstances where the person has a reasonable expectation of personal privacy includes, but is not limited to a bathroom, dressing room, those sorts of situations.
So personal privacy isn't that they expect to be alone. They just expect not to be exposed.
Videotaped, yes. Okay. And I would argue that the predator's actions by videotaping a child in the same circumstances or the same place by that person videotaping the child changes that child's circumstances. If the concern about removing the language post-pubescent is a concern for the committee, I can't imagine that any prosecutor or overzealous law enforcement officer would ever pursue a parent for videotaping their child or taking a photograph of their child in their bedroom.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Did you want to speak too?
Yes, Chair Burdick, very briefly. For the record, my name is Brenda Wilson. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene, and I just wanted to get on the record that although Senate Bill 627 was introduced at the request of Detective Brazil personally, the City of Eugene strongly supports the bill and the strengthening of laws regarding invasion of privacy and specifically the enhancement of the protection for those under the age of 16. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. And thank you for your patience. It was a longer day than we thought. Okay. We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 627, and we are adjourned.